Our fourth case of the day, 04-3759, Susan Whitaker versus Northern Illinois University. Mr. McCauley.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Donnan McCauley. I'm here representing appellant plaintiff Susan Whitaker. And to be consistent with prior references to Ms. Whitaker, the record refers to her as Susan, and I will do so today. In her appeal, she's asking that the summary judgments entered by District Court Judge Reinhardt back on September 29, 2004 be vacated and that this case remanded to the District Court for a trial by jury. In her complaint, and we're not really disagreeing with the characterization by Judge Reinhardt on the issues that were presented, it's a disparate treatment case that has elements of disparate treatment, hostile environment, retaliation. And separately, the plaintiff presented a partial summary judgment motion under Section 1983 against one of the defendants, John Slater, who was her immediate foreman. And based on the very brief opinion of Judge Reinhardt dismissed the 1983, basically saying because he was dismissing the Title VII. And I think there's some elements of the Title VII, such as similarly situated employees, that apply under rationale for Section 1983. And it would be my procedure just to address those together.
Well, before you get to that, can you tell me what adverse employment action that she suffered? I know you raised that three-day suspension, but since she left work before the suspension took place, I'm having some trouble understanding how she suffered any economic harm from the suspension.
Well, we believe she still suffered economic harm because she would have had accrued vacation and accrued sick leave on the record, and her civil service record shows that she had that, so that pay would have come off of that. And I think in a supplemental decision that the appellant has provided, I believe it was the West case, the fact that there had been a notice of removal in the West case versus McNeil Pharmaceutical, that even though it's removed, that would still be an adverse consequences. In the case of appellant Susan herein, she also had a 10-day suspension that was put on her record, I believe the date was May 4th, which preceded her going on medical disability, that was then later removed because she grieved it under the union grievance procedure, but I still would argue that that's an adverse consequence in addition to the three-day suspension.
And you'd say that's true even though she left work before the suspension could take effect?
Yes, because it's still on her civil service record, and contrary to what the university would argue, she did not voluntarily leave her employment. Her employment, as the medical records show that have been a restricted document to this court, shows that she left, and the opinion there was the fact that she left because of the harassment received from her supervisors at the university.
When and how did she learn that her superiors referred to her in derogatory terms?
Well, she learned some of that in 1999 through some secondary associations with other employees. In fact, the thing about derogatory references, there was one, and this is contrary to the district court, there was one that was directly to her face from, at that time, Defendant Wilhelm, who was her supervisor, who I believe the reference was something like stupid cunt or dumb cunt, that was said to her directly to her face in an elevator incident as she was seeking help for workplace injustices from the University Ombudsman's Office.
And these other things that were indirect said to other people, were those, did she find out about those after she left? That's what I'm trying to get a handle on. I know there were 99.
I believe she heard of a couple of them indirectly prior to her leaving in mid-May of 99. I don't know that the record reflects that. Most of the derogatory comments come out, and we would treat those as admissions. They come from university foremen, and that's their term. I'm not trying to be using foreperson or anything, but that comes from their foreman, and that is one point where we take issue with the district court. The district court made the point that derogatory statements have no effect unless they're made to the person. I think...
Well, they don't have any effect as far as a hostile environment.
Right. Claim.
True, and I believe there's a case, that's one of the supplemental cases that was provided to this court. I believe it was Etzel versus Potter, federal employee postmaster case, where that same point was made that the audience doesn't make any difference as to this. And that's our point with...
Well, that's what my point was with the timing, because it doesn't help your hostile work environment claim if it's after she left.
No, they were all before.
And I mean in terms of her learning about them. About the comments. She
Correct.
Has to know about the comments.
Yes, and I'm saying she didn't know all of them before she left, but the other point I was making, that the judge's comment, was the fact that as to maybe hostile environment, because they weren't said to her face, it might apply, but as to disparate treatment, and that brings in this what we've been arguing, which encompasses a lot of the problem we have with the district court decision, is it's appellant's position that this paradigm of McDonnell Douglas was not proper in the case, that the proper consideration and the proper way to make the determination is more appropriately now to be Desert Palace v. Costa. And the reason that's said is because we tie in Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, the case that says in making a summary judgment decision, you have to look at what would a reasonable jury decide. Well, from appellant's perspective, taking McDonnell Douglas, which attempts to find intentional discrimination using circumstantial evidence, but uses this but for. In other words, McDonnell Douglas is set up at a time, and it goes back to 1973, when...
And I hate to interrupt here, but we deal with McDonnell Douglas all the time. What I want to know is, what evidence do you have that the derogatory remarks used by her superiors played any role or any part in the alleged adverse employment action?
Well, we believe that those derogatory comments are sufficient and part of the circumstantial evidence to show the motivation, or the motivation of the defendants, was based on appellant's gender or female sex. And we do that because of the timing. We do that because Foreman Slater said, and it's in the record once, that plaintiff's complaint was brought up. He had said, and I can't find the direction, but he can't find his exact words, but summarizing, it was to the effect that Susan Whitaker was not going to hang him, but someone was guilty. Also, the timing of the fact that in May of 1998, Susan turns down Slater's proposition for a date on a weekend on his boat. And then you got the testimony of Foreman Hetland and Foreman Dvorak that all of a sudden Susan was no longer a hot-looking woman, given in a favorable sense, but she was now, to use the derogatory words, like a fucking slut or a goddamn whore. And that sequence right then, after that incident, you then find in September of 98, Susan gets a written warning for not cleaning a light over 10 feet, for her job description said she doesn't have to do it. You then get the fact that Slater gives this negative performance evaluation. specifically saying she has a tardy problem, but his maintenance of her attendance records don't show that. Yet he's doing that in the official university performance appraisal. And then, I guess because that wasn't going to get rid of her quick enough, there then became this, what I call corruption of the absentee tardy policy. In other words, Susan's absence, the one that jumps out is the March 9, 1999, which was a snowstorm, where every employee gets no discipline, no nothing. Although Susan is shown on the record that Slater keeps to have a vacation day, she then gets disciplined for a no-call, no-show. There then becomes other instances where they're trying to build up this absenteeism rationale, which is totally contrary
all
to
that,
what...
All that may show is intent to discriminate, but those aren't hostile work actions, are they? And they don't count as adverse actions.
Well, initially, no, because I know this court doesn't take warnings, but I'm just saying this is the pattern that's building up to create the adverse actions, such as the three-day warnings. It also creates the adverse consequences that creates what
now,
has shown her...
Now, does the three-day suspension have any economic effect?
Yes.
Is that demonstrable in the record?
Well, to me, it's demonstrative on the record because her civil service record shows that this is 3 days is there and it would be taken away from any of her pay. Plus, nowhere in the district court level, the defendants did not argue that it had no effect. They said it was, in the district court, they only said that all legitimate discipline, it was all legitimate discipline, and I believe in the district court, they didn't argue that the three-day suspension was not an adverse thing. I just need to bring up, when you talk about treatment between Susan and males, the district court ignored an instance, and this goes to the similarly situated employees, back on November 4th concerning a building service male employee by the name of Wayne Bankston, who was issued a 10-day suspension for, quote, pattern of regular absences and abuse of benefits. The NIU review official, Tom Morlock, who would have been the same review official in Susan's case, and it was for one suspension, said the 10-day suspension had to be thrown out because the conduct was covered by the building services absentee tardy policy, and Bankston had not reached the level of the policy necessary to support the 10-day suspension. However, when it gets to Susan's case, if you look at Susan's May of 99 claims, she's alleged to have committed, same as Bankston, a pattern of regular abuses and abusive benefits, to which she is then disciplined, and the district court said, well, no, she's not similar to Bankston because Susan was disciplined for insubordination, not violation of the policy. And that's the argument of Susan, is saying the district court erred when it tried to look at how the employer characterized the conduct. The conduct of Bankston and Susan was the same. Talking about insubordination, where an employee by the name of Mose Morton committed an act of insubordination against Slater, Slater did not discipline him. Totally contrary. And unless there's any question, I see my rebuttal light is on. I'll wait for that opportunity.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Huzzack, Assistant Attorney General, counsel for the defendants in this case, and I urge the court to affirm the district court's entry of summary judgment in their favor for two reasons, the principal being that there has been no proof of any cognizable injury redressable by Title VII, either as to the sexual harassment, hostile work environment claim, nor as to the disparate treatment and retaliation claims. I think the briefs at least fully set forth our position with respect to those issues, so I would like to focus on the court's questions on the matters that are of greatest concern to us. Directing myself first to the question regarding whether there's any evidence of any economic impact from the three-day suspension, there is none whatsoever. The plaintiff's reply brief indicates at page 12 in footnote 2 that the defendants have not proven that she did not suffer an economic consequence, and they surmise that perhaps this three-day suspension was in fact applied economically by deducting the suspension time from her accrued vacation or sick time. There is no evidence of that. The way a suspension without pay operates is that when the employee is working, they work. They are then told not to appear for 3 days, and they're docked 3 days for that time when they would otherwise be working. The plaintiff in this case stopped coming to work. Her summary judgment opposition, filed in 2004, 5 years after these events, indicates that she still has not returned to work. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. There is no evidence in the record that she suffered any economic injury from this. And although I understand that this court has no specific precedent on point, the Sixth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuits have both indicated that in this type of circumstance, where there is never an observance or an imposition of this type of suspension, that it does not qualify as an adverse employment action.
What about, I mean, could it be possible that even if there's no loss of pay, if there's an employee who had previously been suspended for violating a particular rule, then might be subject to enhanced discipline or more discipline? And that really, we could look at this case and say, isn't that what happened to Whitaker? She first received a written reprimand, then the 3-day suspension, then almost got the 10-day suspension. Each was sort of successive in terms of discipline. And so could that qualify as an adverse employment action?
I would say it would not. If there were a culmination of events, and again, assuming that you can prove some type of discriminatory motive as to each of them, that at the end of the day resulted in some type of economic injury or a non-economic injury of the degree of severity that the court has recognized, for example, in the Grube and in the Spearman cases, that although there's no financial impact, nonetheless is so onerous that it would qualify as an adverse employment action. In that situation, which is different from the one presented here, there might be the whole is greater than the sum of the parts type situation. But really, we don't have that. And I think it's important to emphasize what the court just noted. Although the plaintiffs place great emphasis upon the proposed 10-day suspension, and they repeatedly refer to that in their brief as if it's the same as the actual 3-day suspension decision that was final, the proposed 10-day suspension was never approved. It went through the grievance procedure, and the same hearing officer, Mr. Morlock, who had said that it was not going to apply to this other individual, said that it wasn't going to apply to her. And it's not that we were claiming that there was a different ground for imposition for that proposed decision by Mr. Followell. Insubordination applied to the 3-day suspension because she had in the past failed to show up on, not just show up or show up on time, but it failed to call. And there's a different employer policy behind the need to have people call when they're not going to show and just not showing up at all, assuming they do call. Here, the distinction was that she didn't call repeatedly within the time that she was supposed to call, and she's got this far-fetched, I think, conjectural theory that somebody rigged the records and jiggered the documents and phonied things up. There's no evidence for any of that.
But wasn't the university's policy not to suspend an employee for absenteeism until the sixth occurrence? And here, it was the second occurrence where it was deemed insubordination.
That's the clarification that I think needs to be absolutely emphasized, is that she was never disciplined for absenteeism.
Well, why did her absences constitute insubordination?
No, the absences don't. It's not calling in. She was accused of abusing.
Not calling in amounts to insubordination.
She was warned one time. She said, "You know, we've got buildings to clean. If you're not going to come, if you're not going to show up, you give us a call and let us know. That's the policy. It applies to everybody." She not only failed to show up, she failed to call. She received a warning for that, and it happens again. And her supervisor says, "Hey, you were warned. This is depriving us of the ability to cover these responsibilities in a timely fashion."
Well,
didn't she identify
some male employees who were let off the hook who were absent or failed to call in two times or more?
No. She pointed to one other employee who did not show up, who had an absentee problem that's similar to the one that she had, although I don't know that there was evidence that he was abusing sick leave to take vacation that he didn't have the accrued right to take. She also was absent. There was a recommendation, like for this other employee, that she receive discipline. In both cases, neither of them received any discipline for not showing up. There is no other employee that failed to call, which is a different obligation and a different policy. And she never disputes that she's the only person that she can there's no comparator with respect to the discipline imposed upon her for not calling.
So then is it your position that all employees who fail twice to call in would be insubordinate?
I don't know what the university's policy is. I believe that that's the case. Insubordination is defined as essentially failing to follow a clear direction of your employer with respect to an existing policy. This is exactly what happened. She was told, if you're not going to come, you need to call us and let us know. And within a space of, I think it was at most 2 months, it happened again. And her supervisor said, we told you, you can't do this. I'm going to write you up. It went through the process. The supervisor indicated that he reviewed the records. It then went through a grievance procedure. The grievance officer determined that there was grounds for insubordination. She tries to compare herself with another employee for supposed insubordination, treating all insubordination as equal, although it's not. That employee, on one occasion, had uttered a swear word directed at his supervisor and received a written warning. It's not that there was no discipline within the meaning of the university's policies. There was no discipline as that term is defined for Title VII. So the efforts to try and find circumstantial evidence of unlawful intent by a comparison with other individuals ultimately collapses when you look at the evidence on these things. The court also asked, was the plaintiff ever aware of any of these derogatory or sexist comments made about her before she left her employment? There is none whatsoever. There's nothing in the record that indicates she was aware of any of this. I've addressed in my brief, in footnote 10, page 18, the lack of evidentiary support for the plaintiff's assertion that one of these alleged derogatory comments was made to her face. The evidence doesn't support it. That's not in the record. There's no evidence that she was aware of any of this before she left. The plaintiff contests the characterization that she voluntarily left employment, essentially suggesting that this was a constructive discharge type case. The court's precedents establish that the threshold for showing a constructive discharge is significantly higher than that for showing the objective element of a sexual harassment, hostile workplace environment. And I think the record is clear that she doesn't even have that lower threshold, much less the substantially greater threshold to show constructive discharge. The general policy is you are expected to stay on the job and pursue whatever grievances you have internally rather than just unilaterally leaving and later saying, well, I couldn't stay. And there's nothing in the record that would support her characterization that she was subject to a constructive discharge for the two incidents to which she attributes her departure, which is her supervisor a year earlier having invited her to go on his boat for drinking and fun, and then all of these other comments that she wasn't even aware of, that there's no evidence she was aware of. There is no other evidence tying these comments or any other circumstantial evidence indicating that the three-day suspension, if the court were to treat it as an adverse employment action, as being unlawfully motivated. The the spurning of his advances, if they can be characterized in that fashion, occurred a year before this incident. There's nothing about the supposed sexist comments made by these people in the foreman's office, in the supervisor's office, that are related to this job decision or that are even connected in time to this type of job decision. Ultimately, I think what we have is a woman who believes that 10 years earlier she complained of being sexually harassed by her earlier supervisor, and that somehow that immunized her from normal discipline for regular misconduct or failing to perform her duties. That is not the case. What happened here was based upon the materials presented to the ultimate foreman on this job, Mr. Followell. He reviewed them. He made the decision. It was upheld in a grievance procedure. It was justified by the facts. And the plaintiff's attempts now to say that she was the victim of intolerable sexual harassment or the victim of retaliation or discrimination is unsupported by the facts, and I urge the court to affirm the district court's entry of summary judgment in their favor. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes.
May it please the court, let me just make what may seem to be disjointed comments, but I think it's important for the court to know. The trying to parse the absence tardy policy as the university now has tried to do versus call-in versus absence, it's all covered under the policy. The policy is in the record. You read when it talks about an unscheduled absence, it includes not calling in, not showing up. The parsing by defendants just does not hold water under their own policy. As to a policy for insubordination, Superintendent Falwell, who was one of the main actors in the building services, testified in his deposition that there is no policy in building services on insubordination. In fact, in his deposition, he was asked to give examples of what insubordination would be, and he could not. He could not give one example of how you would define insubordination. The other point I would make, and that's the reference in the brief to Banks versus Office, it's Office of Banks, we'll say, talks about derogatory comments, circumstantial evidence, and so forth, bringing up something that can be an inference of discrimination to a jury. And that's the point that Susan is here today making. Altogether, Susan deserves a chance to have a jury decide the facts and so forth. The facts in front of the district court, there are material disputes as to whether or not she called in or not. In fact, even foremen disagree as to whether or not a foreman took the call. Wilhelm, a foreman, said he didn't take a call on April 27th. Slater, the other foreman, has in his own notes that Wilhelm took a call. So when you look at it, there are very material disputed facts, including the motivation that shows that sex was the motivation. And if there's no question, I see my red light is on.
Thank you. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll proceed to